A few things before we get started. First, parts of this episode will be far more from a personal perspective than a usual episode of Gone Cold. Every case we cover is immensely important to us, but as longtime listeners know, Carla's story, the bonds we've made with her family, schoolmates, and friends, and the developments in the case since we started the podcast have kept us emotionally engaged going on 5 years. So our more personal approach here is inevitable and impossible to avoid. We will not be summarizing the details of Carla's story at the beginning of this episode, as we have in our previous updates, in hopes that y'all are familiar, or will at least stop this and listen to our very first several episodes to get familiar before proceeding. However, some of the testimony covered here will go over the details of what happened that night in February of 1974 and the aftermath. On that note, it would be impossible for us to cover every single aspect of the first day of the capital murder trial of Glenn Samuel McCurley, but since I had the weekend to work on this, day one will likely have the most in-depth coverage. I'm going to do my best to highlight the most consequential aspects while going over the day's proceedings and testimony in the order in which they occurred, for the most part. While there will be some verbatim quotes going forward, a large part of what follows will be my paraphrasing and interpretation of the first day of trial. This episode is in large part based on my perspective, but there will be plenty of facts, have no fear. Lastly, the next several episodes we release will be updates on this trial. I do not know precisely how many there will be, but I'll get them out as quickly as humanly possible. Okay, that's it. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Jury selection for the state of Texas versus Glenn Samuel McCurley began and was completed on Thursday, August 19th, 2021. Not able to be there, of course, I obsessed over the process the entire day. That evening offered no respite. Even after attempting to soothe my nerves with several glasses of straight rye whiskey, I had trouble sleeping the night before day one of the capital murder trial of Glenn McCurley, who stands accused of the 1974 slaying of 17-year-old Carla Jan Walker. In spite of the previous evening's attempt at self-medication, I only hit snooze on my phone's alarm once, maybe a new record for me, before getting up on the morning of Friday, August 20th, 2021, and preparing for what was sure to be a long and arduous day. The anxiety in anticipation of the day's proceedings had not waned any. Little did I know at that point it would get considerably worse. I couldn't help but obsess over the anguish and pain the day would offer Carla's living siblings, Jim and Cindy Walker, and Rodney McCoy, who was another victim of the monster who killed his girlfriend Carla, as well as a victim of years of speculation that he was guilty of this heinous crime by gossip vultures who feed off decaying rumor while ignoring and leaving behind the bare bones facts and evidence. As soon as I hit East Belknap Street, coming in from Texas State Highway 121, the traffic into downtown Fort Worth was backed up, caused by, I eventually discovered, a car wreck near my destination, the Tim Curry Criminal Justice Center. The man for whom this building is named served as the Tarrant County District Attorney for 36 years, one of the longest-serving DAs in the state's history. He had held that position for almost 1.5 years when Carla Walker was abducted, raped, and slain on February 17, 1974. After maneuvering through traffic and parking outside the building that houses the Tarrant County Sheriff's downtown office, I finally made it to the hallway outside Tarrant County Criminal Court 1 at about 8:15 a.m. I had 15 minutes to spare before the trial was set to begin. After hugging Carla's brother and sister, Jim and Cindy, I had just enough time to enjoy the pleasure of meeting a few fine folks who I'd only interacted with on social media or by phone, friends and Walker and McCoy family members whose acquaintances are incredibly important to me. I'm leaving out names only because I neglected to ask if it was okay to mention them. but the experience certainly helped ease my shaky nerves, if only momentarily. The hallway seemed jam-packed, but after we were instructed to enter the small courtroom and everyone was seated, seating for a few more bodies remained. There was an overflow room where folks who couldn't bear to see the excruciatingly horrific images that were to come could sit and hear the proceedings, so perhaps some made their way to that space at the get-go. Not long after everyone was settled in, we all rose as Judge Elizabeth Beach entered the courtroom. Instructed to rise again for the jury, we stood for what seemed like an eternity, about 10 minutes, I guess, as we waited for the 12 folks to enter. A majority of the jurors were masked up. 9 were women and 3 were men. Judge Beach instructed the 4 alternate jurors, 2 men and 2 women, to sit in the seats farthest to the left. The accused, Glenn Samuel McCurley, entered the courtroom in a wheelchair unaided, and unlike his appearances at the pretrial hearings, he wore no mask and no forest green Tarrant County jailhouse jumpsuit. Instead, the man was dressed in a white long-sleeve button-up dress shirt and black slacks. McCurley had grown a beard while in jail, the color multiple shades of gray and white. Oddly, in front of a jury, the man seemed much less aged and ailing than he had during pretrial proceedings. I thought the opposite would have been instructed by his defense in an attempt to garner the jury's sympathy and pity. I certainly seem to have been incorrect in that prediction. When both sides were settled in, the state read the charges against the accused. I'm going to quote it here directly from the indictment since I couldn't write fast enough. Charge 1, quote, Glenn Samuel McCurley on or about the 17th day of February 1974 in the county of Tarrant, state of Texas, did intentionally cause the death of Carla Walker by strangling her with his hands and or with his arm, and the said defendant was in the course of committing or attempting to commit the offense of aggravated rape against Carla Walker. It is further presented in and to said court that the defendant in the county of Tarrant and state aforesaid on or about the 17th day of February 1974 did intentionally cause the death of Carla Walker by strangling her by a means which is unknown, and the said defendant was in the course of committing or attempting to commit the offense of aggravated rape against Carla Walker. Count 2. It is further presented in and to said court that the defendant in the county of Tarrant and state aforesaid on or about the 17th day of February 1974 did intentionally cause the death of Carla Walker by strangling her with his hands and or with his arm, and the said defendant was in the course of committing or attempting to commit the offense of kidnapping against Carla Walker. It is further presented in and to said court that the defendant in the county of Tarrant and state aforesaid on or about the 17th day of February 1974 did intentionally cause the death of Carla Walker by strangling her by a means which is unknown, and the said defendant was in the course of committing or attempting to commit the offense of kidnapping against Carla Walker, against the peace and dignity of the state. End quote. McCurley pleaded not guilty to both counts, and Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon presented the state's opening statement. What came across crystal clear from the get-go was that the evening, which began on the 16th of February 1974, should have been a normal one, a cherished teenaged memory that Carla Walker should have been able to recall on command as she grew old. Perhaps alongside her high school sweetheart, Rodney McCoy, the other victim in this story. But Carla's life was cut short after she endured an unimaginable series of acts of physical and sexual violence, allegedly at the hands of Glenn Samuel McCurley, who could be heard on tape at the end of the day referring to Carla as, quote, the little girl that got captured, end quote. That's an interesting choice of words uttered by the man, but it's far from the only interesting thing heard on that very same tape. But we'll get to that later. Anyway, Prosecutor Emily Dixon's words were straight to the point. She outlined the details of Carla's abduction and murder and the ensuing investigation. The technology needed to solve the crime did not exist in 1974, but almost as soon as it was available in 2020, that technology led to the accused. It was a great opening statement, confident in the state's ability to provide the burden of proof as to Glenn Samuel McCurley's guilt, and it came with a promise of sharing Carla's voice through witness testimony, since she could not be the voice herself. McCurley's defense attorney, Stephen Meyer, went back over the abduction and murder of Carla Walker. He spoke of the high-profile nature of the case, as it was happening in real time back in 1974. The scope of the investigation was huge, Meyer said, and the investigators did everything they could, leaving no stone unturned. His client was thoroughly examined and cleared, Meyer told the jurors. That statement is misleading. Unless I'm misunderstanding, Glenn McCurley was never cleared. The cops just didn't have any evidence to charge him with anything. That is certainly not the meaning of cleared. The defense attorney described Rodney McCoy's pistol whipping and how the magazine belonging to a .22 caliber Ruger pistol was left behind at the scene. But his client, Meyer went on, was only one of many folks in the area who purchased magazines for a .22 Ruger. He told jurors that the partial fingerprint found on the Ruger magazine didn't match McCurley, though Meyer didn't include the word partial. According to the defense, there was no evidence that McCurley was involved in, quote, sexual activity. No evidence that their client and Carla, quote, had sex. I understand what they're getting at, but this particular piece of the statement was maddening, disgusting, and again, misleading in more ways than one. Carla's body was untouched by animal or bug activity, the defense said. A seed planted, suggesting that the defense is going to later argue that Carla's body hadn't been in the culvert long. There were no shoe prints of McCurley's found on the scene, Meyer went on, no fingerprints found on Rodney's car, and no tire tracks from the accused's vehicle. The very first incident report was made by a Benbrook, Texas police officer who responded to the Walker home after Carla was abducted. It stated that Rodney McCoy reported 5 to 6 individuals taking Carla. This is further explored in Rodney's testimony coming up. Meyer told the jury that the single-source DNA found on Carla's bra was questionable. He questioned the adherence to the evidence chain of command over the years and suggested that the evidence was likely contaminated, and that argument is going to get really weird later. The defense then tugged at the heartstrings of the 12 jurors when he told them of his client's ailments. The 78-year-old is diabetic and has cancer, Meyer told them, and during his 4-hour interrogation, detectives promised him he wouldn't sit in the electric chair or hang at the gallows. I mean, they're not wrong. Meyer was seemingly suggesting that his client's confession was coerced. He asked the jurors for a not guilty verdict. The state then called their first witness, Rodney McCoy. Bear with me as I pause for a word from this episode's sponsors. This summer, I've been trying to reset my brain with some me time, what little I can muster up, by collecting and reading old detective magazines with Texas true crime cases. But I also dig a little challenge when I'm trying to unwind, and that's where the Match 3 mobile puzzle game Best Fiends comes in. I'm currently on level 4400, so needless to say, once I started playing Best Fiends, I could not stop. The levels have gotten significantly more challenging, which is exactly what I like, and every level has a different strategy than the last. Lucky for me, Best Fiends has thousands of levels, and new levels and events are added all the time. There's a lot to love about the game. The bright colors, the cool characters, a variety of bugs and other small creatures, the fiends in Best Fiends, if you will, and those dastardly bad guy slugs you set out to defeat. Rose, the praying mantis, is my current favorite fiend. So download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends Free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. When Rodney McCoy took the stand, prosecutor Emily Dixon began a series of questions about the 65-year-old's past. He was born in Fort Worth and grew up mostly in Benbrook, Rodney told the court. And by the time his senior year at Western Hills High rolled around, he was working at the service station operated by his second stepfather. Also, in his senior year, Rodney was both a quarterback and defensive end for the football team, the Cougars, number 15. He officially met Carla his junior year when he accompanied a good friend's sister to the Walker home to pick something up. Carla, then a sophomore, was on her bed doing homework. She didn't even notice me, Rodney remembered thinking. That actually was not true at all, according to the many friends of Carla's we talked to. But anyway, Rodney sure noticed her. Not long after, both Carla and Rodney attended a party, and he couldn't keep his eyes off of her on the other side of the bonfire. The two finally talked that night, and before either knew it, they were going on their first date. It was called a backwards dance, where Carla asked Rodney on the date. Between Rodney's recollections of the blossoming romance and his quickly developed bond with the Walker family, the state introduced a large photograph of he and Carla sitting in her Monte Carlo. In February of 1974, Carla and Rodney had been a couple for around a year, he explained. On the 16th of that month, Rodney was late to pick up Carla for the Western Hills High Valentine's Day dance. In his rush to get out the door after cleaning up the day's evidence of service station work, he had forgotten the corsage and had to go back for it. Rodney got the look for his tardiness, he fondly remembered in front of the jury. But Carla eased up the scowl when he pinned the corsage on her dress. They left in Rodney's mom's 69 Ford LTD and dined at a local seafood joint before heading to the high school, Rodney testified. They attended the dance for a while, sneaked drinking booze while there, and left with a couple friends to drive around some. Because the bathrooms at the Taco Bell had been vandalized and were subsequently closed to the public, many of the teenaged cruisers used the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley to relieve themselves. The two couples, in fact, ended up there for that purpose, and after dropping off the other couple, Rodney and Carla ended up there again. They went in, did their thing, and returned to the Ford LTD, Rodney testified, which was parked in the back parking lot of the bowling alley, separated from the establishment by Marquita Drive. In the car, the couple began making out, Carla's head cushioned by her purse against the passenger side door, Rodney on top of her. They were not having sex, Rodney said when he was asked, only making out. Without hint or warning, the passenger side door was jerked open. Both Carla and Rodney fell toward the abruptly opened door, and as he held onto her, he felt blows to the top of his head. The sudden shock caused Rodney to instinctively let go of Carla to defend against these blows. He told the court that Carla yelled, "Stop hitting him." It all happened fast, and somehow, Rodney didn't know exactly how, Carla was out of the car. Blood from the head wounds filled Rodney's eyes, and when he looked up, a gun was at his face. The gun clicked 3 times. The person began pistol-whipping 18-year-old Rodney again, he said, this time with a sideways swing as opposed to an up-and-down motion. He thought he'd been shot. Rodney couldn't see the person but could make out the features of a man. "My dad owns the bowling alley," Rodney remembered Carla saying to the man. Mr. Walker did not in fact own it. Carla likely only thought saying such a thing might help them in some way, perhaps scare the man off. "You're coming with me," Rodney heard the man say. The last thing Rodney remembered before losing consciousness was making eye contact with Carla as she told him to go get Dad. That's exactly what he did when he came to an unknown amount of time later, and after wiping away the blood covering his eyes. Though my view of Glenn Samuel McCurley in the courtroom was poor, I would swear he was smirking as Rodney McCoy recalled the traumatic and terrifying events. When he arrived at the Walker home, he frantically told Carla's parents what had happened. The cops were called, and Rodney went to the hospital for treatment. Again, if you'd like much more detail on these events, they can be found in our first several episodes. Rodney's accounts are all in there, in his own voice and as told to us. When a body was found 3.5 days later in a cattle culvert near Benbrook Lake, just shy of 10 miles from the bowling alley, it was identified as Carla's the same day. Rodney nearly fell completely apart in court when recalling Carla's father's pain. She was his little flower, Rodney had said earlier, and a father figure to him, he told us about 4 years ago. To no objections from defense, State's Exhibits 5-16 were admitted into evidence. They were photographs of Rodney's mother's 69 LTD, the bench seat covered in blood, his white shirt soaked in blood around the collar and shoulders, turned the color of rusty mud by the 47 years that have passed since that horrible night. Also in the photos were Rodney's head and face injuries, and a few were of Carla's purse and a .22 Ruger magazine left behind at the scene of the abduction. In the photographs of the LTD, Carla's corsage and the Taco Bell cup she'd been drinking rum and coke from could be seen resting on the floor next to the bench seat's passenger side. Rodney recalled the vehicle being turned back over to his family relatively quickly, and also remembered cleaning the blood from the seats himself. Prosecutor Emily Dixon had one more question, after making clear it might seem like a strange one. Was Carla married? She asked. Rodney replied that she was not. The witness was passed to the defense for cross-examination. Defense attorney J. Eric Nichols asked Rodney McCoy if he remembered telling police that 4 to 5 people were involved in Carla's kidnapping, to which the witness replied he did not recall ever saying such a thing. This question is in reference to the first incident report filed in this case by the Benbrook police. Nichols then asked Rodney if he told his friend Bobby, "That's the guy," after viewing a police lineup back in 1974. "It's the only police lineup Rodney had ever seen," he said, and he told the court he did not remember telling anyone that. This lineup, if I'm not mistaken, included the serial killer Tommy Ray Neeland. The question was likely raised to provide the jury with reasonable doubt by way of an alternate suspect. Rodney McCoy was excused. The state called their second witness, the man who discovered Carla Walker's body in a culvert on what was then known as Holiday Park Lane. Daryl Thompson began his law enforcement career with the Fort Worth Police in 1969 and retired from there in 1980. After that, he moved to the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office. Before becoming a homicide detective in 1975, Thompson was assigned to what was known as Foot Patrol, where he patrolled high-crime areas. In February of 1974, after Carla's abduction, Thompson told the court, the department was utilizing all available resources to find the missing 17-year-old. He and his partner Steve Noonkester took the southwest area of Benbrook Lake to patrol, since other officers were already assigned to the west and northwest sections. On the afternoon of February 20th, the partners took turns getting out of their cruiser to look under culverts. "It was a nice day, but pretty cool out," Thompson said. He discovered Carla's body on what became his last turn. He testified that he stayed back while Officer Noonkester raced to a payphone to alert the department. They did not want to radio it in from the cruiser, since the press was scanning the police band, waiting on the scoop. Thompson kept an eye on the scene until homicide detectives and crime scene investigators could arrive. A map of the location of the culvert relative to the bowling alley, aerial photographs of the culvert, and a photo of the inside of the culvert where Carla's body laid were introduced and admitted into evidence, with no objections from the defense. Though he stuck around, Thompson had nothing to do with the crime scene, he told the court. He was there to keep the reporters in line. As a homicide detective, Darryl Thompson later worked Carla's case, but initially he was only among those who searched for the owners of .22 caliber Ruger pistols, inspecting them for signs of Rodney's blood or tissue. After the witness was turned over to the defense for cross-examination, not much happened other than Nichols asking Thompson what time he found Carla's body. Afternoonish was basically his answer. The next witness was Jack Bolton, who worked as a Fort Worth policeman from 1970 to 1980. Bolton was working as a crime scene investigator in 1974 and was called to the culvert to film the crime scene there on February 20th. He was also present at the autopsy. He was the first one in the culvert with Carla's body, Bolton testified, and it was his first time using a color 8mm Kodak camera. The change from black and white film was relatively new to the department at the time. Exhibit 26A was introduced by the state to no objections, a film of the scene. The footage played in court. Some in attendance left prior to the showing, and some during. Several of Carla's friends and family shed tears. Although the footage was a bit choppy, the horror of what happened to Carla Walker was abundantly clear. Also projected in court were exhibits 21 to 24, photographs of Carla's body in the culvert from every conceivable angle. I won't describe the film or the photos other than to say the injuries she sustained were horrific and emotionally disturbing to look at, the work of someone who can only be described as a monster. I regret not leaving the courtroom before they were shown. Unfortunately, there were autopsy photos still to come. Upon cross-examination, McCurley's defense asked if Bolton recalled the officers in the photos. He did not, he responded, because he was day shift and these officers and detectives were night shift. Nichols asked Bolton if the crime scene guys were wearing gloves. Gloves were used in collecting evidence and gathering clothing, Bolton said. The state had no redirect. Judge Elizabeth Beach called a 15-minute recess, perhaps allowing those in attendance to regain their composure after what they had just seen. The state's fourth witness, James Bennett, retired from the Fort Worth Police Department in 1992 after starting his law enforcement career there in 1966. He's no relation to current homicide cold case detective Jeff Bennett, whose work alongside Detective Leah Wagner led to the arrest of the accused. James Bennett worked in the department's major cases unit for most of his time there. This unit handles offenses against persons, from robberies to homicide to sexually motivated offenses. Like Jack Bolton, the previous witness, Bennett was at the culvert shortly after Carla's body was discovered there. It was pretty chilly leading up to and on the day of the discovery, Bennett testified, and since the sun didn't shine inside at any time of day, the culvert was particularly cold. I didn't write it down, but I believe he compared it to an icebox, though I cannot be sure. Bennett was on the scene until Carla's body was transferred directly from the culvert to All Saints Hospital for the autopsy. Just before Bennett explained to the court how they determined what model of Ruger the magazine found at the scene of the abduction belonged to, prosecutor Emily Dixon introduced State's Exhibit 27, a stock photo of the determined Ruger model, and Exhibits 28 through 30, more photographs of the injuries Rodney McCoy sustained in the attack. These exhibits were met with no objections and were allowed into evidence by the judge. Same with exhibits 31 through 37, the autopsy photographs. These were equally as horrific and disturbing as the Culvert photos. A large, dark bruise under Carla's left jawbone was the focus of a few. The bags seen on Carla's hands, Bennett testified, were placed there to protect any evidence that might be under her fingernails. This didn't come up at trial, but we reported back in our old episodes that everyone said Carla would have fought like hell against the man who attacked and killed her, and judging by several marks on Carla's body and the fact that they wanted to preserve anything that might be under the fingernails, it appears the friends and family members who said that were right. If this is indeed the case, Carla's killer was likely scratched up after, begging the question, did anyone notice? Perhaps the killer's wife. Anyway, Bennett went on to tell the court that the department had interviewed perhaps 100 or more individuals about 22 caliber Ruger pistols, looking to both account for the whereabouts of the weapons and determine if any owners were missing a magazine. Upon cross-examination by the defense, the most active since the trial began, in fact, McCurley's attorney, Stephen Meyer, asked Bennett when he came on the Carla Walker case. He told the court that when he came in at 8 a.m. the morning of the abduction, he was assigned to assist lead detective George Hudson on the case. Meyer asked the man how many homicides the department worked back then. Bennett replied, many at that time. Interviewing Rodney was among Bennett's first work on the case, he said when asked. The defense wanted to know if Rodney ever mentioned to the ex-policeman five or six individuals being involved in Carla's abduction. No, Bennett replied, adding that the multiple individual thing came from Rodney telling the Walkers, quote, they got her. By they, and this is me saying this, not Bennett, Rodney actually meant an unknown individual. It's not an uncommon thing to say, regardless of what people might tell you. Bennett's answer suggests that he thinks the Benbrook police officer who filled out and filed the initial report was mistaken, and perhaps a bit negligent. The police then were looking for multiple suspects, Meyer asked, likely in an attempt to cause the man to trip over his own words. No, Bennett replied. Meyer went on to ask if Glenn McCurley or his car were ever identified by any witnesses. Not to my knowledge, was Bennett's response. When asked what was collected in the culvert, Bennett told the defense that everything was. A beer bottle, Meyer asked. Bennett did not recall. A reoccurring defense theme was established next. Individuals who confessed to the murder of Carla Walker. From here on out, a man who confessed to Carla's murder in Tennessee in 1978, Jimmy Dean Sasser, is brought up ad nauseum. It's fairly well established that Sasser knew almost nothing about the factual details of Carla's murder. Yet, the defense, in what feels like desperation to me, continually asks witnesses about him going forward. Bennett, answering one of the defense's final cross-examination questions, said he did not know how many Ruger pistol models existed, nor did he know how many magazines existed. On redirect, the state asked Bennett if Rodney McCoy ever spoke of multiple perpetrators in Carla's abduction. The ex-policeman, again, answered no. The defense then said that Rodney must have told someone that, since the initial report detailed as much. I don't know, Bennett replied. The witness was excused, and the state's fifth witness was called. Jim Minter worked for the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office from 1967 to either 1993 or 1994, he told the court. He couldn't remember. While the sheriff's office technically had jurisdiction rights over the entire county, he explained, the department focuses primarily on unincorporated parts of the county and areas that do not have their own law enforcement entity. On February 20, 1974, while working as an investigator, Minter was dispatched from home to the culvert on Holiday Park Lane, where the body of Carla Walker had been discovered. He surveilled the scene immediately upon arrival and told the court that officers from Fort Worth, Benbrook, and the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office were all present. When prosecutor Emily Dixon asked what stuck out at the scene, Minter mentioned hair on a barbed wire fence, one that you had to go through to get to the culvert, and pantyhose discarded not far from Carla's body. The state introduced Exhibit 25, a photograph of the pantyhose lying in what appears to be dirt and grass. Minter went on to testify that Tarrant County Medical Examiner Dr. Felix Quotes carefully removed Carla's clothing at the morgue and placed the items in paper evidence bags. Minter was there and also described Quotes cleaning, photographing, and covering Carla Walker's body. After the slain 17-year-old's parents identified her the evening she was found, the medical examiner performed an autopsy and took blood reference samples. State Exhibits 38 through 42 were then introduced. Two photos of Carla's dress, one back, one front, a photograph of her bra, one of her pantyhose, and another of her underwear. Minter said the multiple jurisdictions agreed to work together on the case, and while he held his own case file, leads were distributed among this task force, investigated, and discussed in daily meetings in which members of all departments were present. Leads pertaining to .22 caliber Rugers and magazines were obtained by record requests from the ATF, or the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, he said. When asked, Minter told the court that he did not interview Glenn McCurley. Rather, Fort Worth PD and lead investigator on the Carla Walker case did. That's George Hudson. Hudson, it should be noted, was only one of a few detectives who did interview McCurley, according to the arrest warrant. The defense asked Minter on cross-examination if the hair he saw on the barbed wire fence was ever tested. Minter replied that it was collected by Fort Worth crime scene investigators. He told the defense that the scene was investigated and evidence collected as it should have been, using standard procedure, when asked if the crime scene investigation was different nowadays, in 2021. Minter explained again that Carla's clothes were removed and bagged by Dr. Quotes at the morgue when the defense attempted to have the man trip over his words. Minter did not falter. Then the defense brought up Jimmy Dean Sasser, who Minter himself picked up in Tennessee alongside Detective Hudson after his confession. The former investigator told the defense that Sasser could not come up with details that matched the known facts. When asked of other confessions, Minter mentioned two separate Colorado suspects who claimed Carla's murder, but like Sasser, they could not provide details that matched the crime. So the defense asked, "False confessions do happen?" "Yes," Minter replied. If you've been keeping up with this case, I'm sure y'all can imagine where the defense is going with that question. Next, they asked Jim Minter something they'd asked several other witnesses, none of whom knew anything about it. Blood, hair, and tissue found on the ceiling of the culvert, as if Carla's killer had carelessly risen up and badly bumped his head as he placed her inside. Minter said he did indeed observe such a thing. The defense asked him if George Hudson checked McCurley's head for an injury that would match that, but Minter had no idea. In fact, he'd only ever heard the accused's name before 2020 at one of the task force briefings when Hudson brought it up back in 74. Upon redirect, Minter confirmed that it was common belief by police in Fort Worth and Tarrant County that Jimmy Dean Sasser only confessed to Carla's murder for a free ride back to Texas. The man is originally from Paris, if I remember correctly, but lived for years in Fort Worth. Then, the defense brought Sasser back up before asking Minter who he thought killed Carla prior to McCurley's arrest. He told them he never had any idea. Presumably, Minter was saying he never had a particular suspect he liked more than the others for it. Jim Minter asked if he could be excused, and that little occurrence got a few laughs. The judge called lunch recess. I was told during this break that every time an ex-police witness answered a defense question with "I don't know," Glenn McCurley, the accused, would produce an unmistakable grin. The last witness on this first day of the state versus Glenn Samuel McCurley was Detective Leah Wagner of the Fort Worth Police. She told the court that she's been in law enforcement for 21 years. Detective Wagner started out in patrol, as all police officers do, and currently works as a homicide cold case detective. There are almost 1,000 cold cases in the city of Fort Worth, she explained to the court, going back to 1959. Prosecutor Emily Dixon asked the detective how she chooses which cold cases to work, and Wagner replied that the decision is often either made by new evidence, such as a CODIS hit, for example, new information brought to their attention, or an email, letter, or phone call from a victim's family member, such as the, quote, frustrated call from Jim Walker in 2018 she received. Detective Wagner was able to begin work on Carla Walker's case in February of 2019 when Detective Jeff Bennett joined her on cold cases. She was shocked, she said, at the amount of evidence associated with the case. Unlike the thick folder-sized file a normal homicide case might have, there were two completely stuffed banker boxes full of files. Detective Wagner explained how she approached reopening Carla's case. First, by reviewing the initial reports, including the offense report and the supplements that followed, and then checked to see what testable physical evidence was available. Wagner was also shocked to see that there was plenty of that as well. The .22 caliber Ruger magazine and Carla's purse, which was found just beside it, were both there, as was all Carla's clothing, Rodney's bloodied shirt, and even things like dirt clumps and cans, presumably meaning Coke or beer cans, I hope we find out. Matching the only known print associated with the case proved futile. It was only a partial and didn't have enough points for accurate comparison. But she knew, Detective Wagner said, that Carla's clothing potentially had DNA on it from a number of possible sources, like touch, blood, or seminal fluid. Funding, however, was a problem. Money goes fast, Wagner said. There isn't much. After working the case for a while from scratch, re-interviewing family, friends, witnesses, and former cops, she and Detective Bennett got a call from NBC Universal about doing a show called The DNA of Murder with Paul Holes. Long story short, the company paid a total of $18,000 to test evidence associated with Carla's case, Detective Wagner testified. This led to a series of events that eventually identified McCurley as a suspect, one who'd never been reinvestigated after his initial interview back in 1974. State's Exhibits 104 through 108 were introduced and ultimately allowed into evidence. For quite a while, the items were carefully unwrapped from their decades-old paper bags. The items were Carla's dress, Carla's bra, the magazine left at the scene of the abduction, Carla's underwear, and her pantyhose. A rubber-gloved Detective Wagner was opening these items for the first time. She explained that anytime she views physical evidence, anytime anyone in the department views physical evidence, the officer in charge of the evidence room opens the items, lets the detectives inspect them, and then repackages the items. This procedure is done to limit cross-contamination and preserve the chain of command. Anyway, Detective Wagner detailed how new DNA technology, using Serological Research Institute in California, or SERI for short, and Othram Labs in the Woodlands, Texas, led to the surname McCurley. The state asked Detective Wagner if the name Glenn Samuel McCurley was in Carla Walker's case file. The answer, of course, was yes. Fort Worth detectives had interviewed the man in April of 1974 because he owned a Ruger. In July of 2020, patrol officers assigned to the area where McCurley lived collected 5 bags of trash from his home, placed on the curb for pickup, Detective Wagner told the court. With that, the state introduced another set of exhibits, photos of the McCurley trash. One showed a white plastic bag unopened, another a photo of a brown paper Home Depot store bag folded over and duct taped, and another still showing 2 crushed McDonald's paper cups and 2 plastic straws in the opened Home Depot bag. Also admitted into evidence was an audio recording of Detectives Wagner and Bennett's visit to the McCurley home, the point of which was to collect a voluntary buccal swab from the suspect. The state asks Wagner if she recognizes Glenn Samuel McCurley in the courtroom. The detective says she does, and the state asks her to point to him. Leah Wagner pointed to Glenn McCurley. Because of a technology glitch, the audio recording was unable to be played right away. As a contingency, perhaps, prosecutor Emily Dixon asks about McCurley's 1974 interview with police. Interestingly, McCurley was approached by detectives at his place of employment and taken to the station for questioning. "I'm no cop, but I have trouble understanding why any old Ruger owner would be confronted at their place of employment without another compounding reason. That seems potentially harmful to that person solely for the fact that they own a gun. Maybe we'll see." Anyway, Detective Wagner said he told them the same allegedly bullshit story, being my word, in his 2020 interview as he had back in 1974. The state asked Wagner about 1978 confessor Jimmy Dean Sasser, who, Wagner replied, had been eliminated, and I believe she meant forensically, although my train of thought was obviously distracted by the next occurrence, rendering my Sasser note here incomplete. When asked about the testing done on the hair found on the barbed wire fence that Jim Minter mentioned in his testimony, the defense cut off the question with an objection before it could even be completed, and that objection was, unfortunately, sustained. Now, this is the only time during the first day of this trial that the defense objected mid-question, so I can't help but obsess about exactly what the question was going to be. Though it will likely remain unknown, Wagner was asked if it produced anything viable, and the detective answered that it did not. After a brief recess, the state was able to correct the pesky technology difficulties that prevented the playing of the McCurley audio recording. Though the day was certainly interesting, eventful, and incredibly emotional, the recording certainly capped it off. It was the visit to the McCurley home with the goal of obtaining a voluntary swab from the accused to compare DNA, which he eventually gave. But not before he and his wife spoke about the man's ailments, his cancer and diabetes, and other personal accounts. The McCurleys spoke about renting various houses from 72 to 78 after moving to the area from Midland. Glenn McCurley worked as a machine tool mechanic and truck driver, they said, and he spoke of his disdain for the discomfort of COVID tests because, quote, "they stick that thing way up there." Since McCurley had been questioned by police about Carla Walker's murder in 1974, it seems likely that he could have easily guessed why homicide cold case detectives were at his house to speak with him. This is only an immediate thought as I write this, but perhaps Glenn McCurley was racking his brain to figure out which one the cops were there to see him about. Anyway, when it finally got around to the very patient detective's point in visiting the couple, Wagner asked them if they remembered a crime that took place in 1974, in which a teenaged girl was abducted from a bowling alley and later found murdered. Mrs. McCurley recalled the name Carla Walker as if she had been dying the entire time to shout it out. "It was strange to me. And stranger still," she proceeded to barely recall the details of her husband being questioned in the case during the initial investigation. "That is merely my interpretation, and perhaps I'm reading too much into it. I am admittedly biased." They had me downtown. There was a girl involved in the thing, McCurley said. Throughout Mr. McCurley's recollections, Mrs. McCurley could be heard saying things like, "Oh, that's right," and "I forgot about that." Concerning the pistol that led detectives to him, the accused said that, quote, "one of my clips went bad on it," end quote. That, too, is an incredibly interesting statement to me, for what I think are obvious reasons. He went on to tell the whole too-convenient bullshit story of going fishing at a creek some weeks before Carla's abduction and murder, hearing some activity near his truck parked up the way, and discovering his .22 Ruger pistol was missing when he returned to his vehicle to check it out. McCurley didn't know if they ever found his stolen gun, he told Wagner and Bennett, but he remembered the cops investigating him for, quote, "the little girl that got captured." That statement is mind-blowingly interesting to me. Sickening. As far as the animal kingdom goes, a predator doesn't abduct or kidnap its prey. Rather, a predator catches, or perhaps captures, its prey. No human I've ever met would describe a kidnapped murder victim as being captured, but perhaps a hunter of other humans, a predator, would. The last part of the audio recording the jury and spectators heard was Detective Wagner explaining to McCurley that the quickest way he could be eliminated as a suspect in this renewed investigation is by voluntarily providing them with a cheek swab for DNA comparison. There is apparently a lot more avoidance disguised as small talk after that statement, and the court did not hear the man's eventual agreement to provide the voluntary swab. But I'm guessing we will eventually. Cross-examination of Detective Leah Wagner by defense ranged from, "What the fuck are you even talking about?" to something I can only interpret as a bizarre and desperate attempt at giving the jury reasonable doubt, which is their job, to be fair. First, the defense seemed to be dead set on Wagner admitting that her first job in law enforcement was for Haltom City. It seemed like a weird thing to focus on. The suburban city is directly to the east of Fort Worth, and Haltom can hardly be considered very far removed from Cowtown. Come at me if you want, Fort Worthians, that's a fact. Anyway, defense attorney J. Eric Nichols grilled Wagner on her evidence handling training, and if it was different in 1974. "I don't know," Detective Wagner said. But Nichols rebutted, "You've seen changes in your 21 years in law enforcement, right?" Wagner replied that she had. What the defense was getting at soon became obvious. Nichols began questioning the touching of separate items of physical evidence with the same gloves, which admittedly and certainly is a valid concern. It got much worse and downright bizarre after that. Nichols asked Detective Wagner how many times the evidence in Carla's case has been handled over the past 47 years. She replied the items had been handled a lot. Oddly, Nichols asked Wagner if Glenn McCurley was placed in a jail jumpsuit when taken in for questioning about the Ruger pistol back in 1974. The detective did not know. The defense also wanted to know if the accused was confronted with any of the physical evidence during his interview back then, meaning Carla's dress or bra. The detective answered again that she did not know. She wasn't there. While the answers to both of these questions seem obvious, McCurley probably was not put in a jumpsuit or shown physical evidence, would be my guess. It is perhaps impossible for Wagner to know for sure. But here's what they were getting at. Nichols' next question was a strange scenario. Was it possible that the detectives who interviewed McCurley in 1974 touched him, then later touched the physical evidence, meaning presumably Carla's dress and bra, transferring the alleged rapist and killer's DNA by touch to those items? Considering the source of the DNA, that seems like a stretch. I doubt Detective Hudson sexually gratified McCurley during questioning just before racing to the evidence room to get all handsy with the physical evidence. Defense Attorney Nichols then established during his cross-examination of Detective Wagner that biological material found on Carla's dress tested negative for semen, but Wagner also said not negative for spermatozoa. It was also established that the partial fingerprint found on the Ruger magazine could not be conclusively matched to any suspect and could not eliminate any suspects, which in turn led to Nichols asking about Jimmy Dean Sasser. Did Wagner ever see a confession written by the man, the defense asked? The detective answered that she had not, only a report of that confession. On redirect, the state introduced Exhibit 110, a blood reference taken from Carla's dress. Just after that, the court was placed on recess for the weekend. Sorry for this episode's abrupt ending, but day one of the trial's ending also felt abrupt. So with that, I'll get something else out to y'all on Monday the 23rd, if all goes well. Because I had the weekend, I was able to go over day one of the trial pretty extensively. Going forward, however, the episodes will be much shorter with far fewer details, but I'll do my best to fit in what I think are the most important aspects and moments. Sources for this episode include McCurley's indictment and the 25 full pages of notes I took during the proceedings. Thanks for listening, y'all.